Kate Brown's book Plutopia is a tale of two cities. One is Richland, an all-American suburb in eastern Washington state. The other is Ozhursk, a closed city in Russia's southern Ural Mountains. What unites these two cities is their role in producing plutonium, a key ingredient in the American and Soviet nuclear arsenals, and one of the world's most toxic substances. I'm Margaret Harris, Physics World's Reviews editor, and in this podcast we'll be hearing from Kate Brown about her book and about what it was like to live in these highly privileged, highly secretive, and, thanks to a long history of safety violations, highly polluted communities. But first, some background. Richland was built in the Second World War as a home for workers at the Hanford Nuclear Reactor, America's main plutonium production facility. Ozhursk followed a few years later, as the Soviets rushed to build their own nuclear deterrent at the nearby Mayak Combine. Neither the Russian nor the American site produces plutonium anymore, but radioactive waste is still a huge problem. In fact, the areas around Hanford and Mayak are some of the most polluted places on Earth. I asked Brown why she decided to write about them.
Well, I wrote my first book about Ukraine, about a borderland between Ukraine and Poland, and it's called A Biography of No Place, and the story in brief is that it's a densely populated multi-ethnic borderland. In 25 years, only Ukrainians are left. And then in another 25 years, no one is left. It's a Chernobyl zone of alienation. And I went to the zone. After I published that book, I finally went to the zone and I had like a tourist trip there for about a week in 2004. And I wrote an article about it, and an editor called me up and said, would you write a whole book about Chernobyl? And I thought about it, and I thought there's an awful lot already written about Chernobyl, but there's these two other places that have, depending on who you ask, 2 to 10 times more spilled radiation than Chernobyl. And that's the plutonium producing factories in the United States and in the Soviet Union, Mayak and Hanford. And I couldn't figure out why Chernobyl's almost a household word, but very few people in this country had heard of Hanford, and certainly almost no one had ever heard of Mayak. And I wondered about that.
Brown says that Chernobyl was a camera-ready event. It was an accident. It happened in one day, and the story played out in public over the next several months. But at Hanford and Mayak, radiation was released over a period of decades. And for the most part, Brown explains, it was done deliberately.
There were some accidents, but most of these spills were disasters by design. This is intentional. Part of the daily operating order was to put radioactive isotopes up as gas, up through stacks, into surrounding rivers, into soils, and into these underground tanks. So that to me was a chilling realization, because these places are not small bomb labs. They're big factories. They employ tens of thousands of people over the course of four decades. And no one, neither in the dictatorial Soviet Union nor in the democratic United States, spoke up. And that really got me. Why no one spoke up?
In her book Plutopia, Brown argues that the reason nobody spoke up is that they were, in effect, bribed. Workers at Hanford and Mayak got paid extremely well, and they and their families received a wide range of benefits, including subsidized housing, excellent schools, and consumer goods that were unaffordable and, in the Soviet Union, unavailable for ordinary workers. The result was a plutonium-based utopia, a plutopia, in which workers identified with and came to trust their bosses. Brown elaborates.
So because people got paid more, they acquired a certain kind of superiority, a sense of superiority, that they were better than their neighbors, that their bosses who had supplied them with such a wonderful quality of life were competent and trustworthy. And so they did believe them when the bosses made assurances that a little bit of radiation is good for the health, that the plant is monitoring the local population and would tell them if they were in danger. These kinds of assurances went a long way when you were inside Plutopia and your managers had managed to do everything else apparently so well in terms of the community.
Eventually, that belief began to break down. The workers at Hanford and Mayak were not, for the most part, trained scientists. But they weren't stupid, and they certainly weren't blind. Didn't they know what was going on?
They didn't know necessarily. Though, it's funny, when you talk to former workers, places like at the Hanford plant, and certainly the Russian workers, they knew. They all say, on both sides of the Iron Curtain, oh, I saw some things. I can't believe I witnessed them. I saw some incredible, unbelievable things that were so dangerous and so wrong. So they knew that their daily working conditions were hazardous and that being on the job was a dicey proposition. And they agreed to it and they got paid to do that. But what was often covered up, specifically by the management of the plant, was how much of these radioactive isotopes were going into the surrounding environment.
Information about environmental damage began to emerge after the Chernobyl accident, which caused some people in Richland and Azhursk to question what they'd been told about safety at Hanford and Mayak. One of the new doubters, a woman who grew up in Richland, told Brown that she had happy memories of going swimming in the nearby Columbia River as a child. She particularly remembers seeking out the warm currents that sometimes appeared in the otherwise chilly Columbia. But she now believes that those warm currents contain radioactive effluent from the Hanford reactor, and she blames her exposure for a lifetime of health problems. Brown collected similar stories from current and former residents of Azhursk, but because Mayak, unlike Hanford, is still reprocessing plutonium fuel for nuclear power plants, the city remains closed to outsiders. I asked Brown how she got around this problem.
Well, I had a contact inside the closed city, and we worked out this deal in which I lived in a cottage as close to Azhursk as I could get, and I stayed there in this cottage with, you know, water from the well, and you had to go heat up the banya and get to take a shower, that kind of thing. But I did have a very modern cell phone, and my contact inside Azhursk would call me and say, "I'm sending one out to you," and she would put usually an elderly person in a cab. And we would have to go to a neutral third location because the person who owned the cottage didn't want it to be known that these dangerous nuclear conversations were happening in their house. And so we went to this office in a sanatorium. And then I would talk to people, and some people met me, learned I was an American, and turned around and left. Others were more brave or more angry, really, about what they felt was their exposure and the health problems that had ensued for themselves, or especially for family members, when kids and grandkids are coming up with these diseases that they connect to radioactive contamination. That made people very angry, and people who had taken vows of silence and had remained silent for 50 years suddenly started to speak.
With some of these people, Brown says it was hard to know how much to believe because their stories seemed so fantastic.
Several people told me, there was a farmer out in eastern Washington, and he told me incredible stories. And I just thought, frankly, when I first spent time with him, I thought he was somebody who had listened to too much late night radio, and he was a conspiracy theorist. He told me crazy stories about how the feds used to come with these stainless steel containers and gather up from the slaughterhouse the organs of their slaughtered cows and sheep, and how, you know, they would have calves with two heads and sheep with, you know, eight legs, that kind of thing. And I frankly didn't believe it. He also told me that the roof of a reactor, he said he used to, as kids, they liked to go on top of the hill and try to look down towards the plant. And he said one time the roof was missing. And I thought that was a crazy story. And so Tom was this unreliable narrator. But as I worked in the archives over the years, almost everything Tom told me turned out to have documentary proof behind it.
To find that documentary proof, Brown had help from several experts, including a biostatistician at the U.S. National Institute of Health and a retired physicist from the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, where Brown teaches. The physicist, Harry Windsor, actually grew up in Richland, and Brown says that at first he was a strong supporter of the Hanford plant, a Richland patriot, in her words. After a couple of years of research, though, his views changed, and he's now very skeptical about what went on there in the 1940s and 50s. Toward the end of the interview, I asked Brown what she hoped other physicists would get from reading her book.
Well, it seems like every major nuclear catastrophe has to happen as if it's for the first time. Around Hanford, the guy who was the head of public health and safety wanted to hand out iodine pills. And he wanted to alert people that there was radioactive isotopes in the drinking water. He was not allowed to do that. Around Mayak, when they had a river with 3.2 million curies of radioactive waste from which people were drinking and bathing and fishing and swimming, They should have evacuated them immediately, but it took 10 years to evacuate these people from the river. And there are still about 8,000 people living on the Tsitsa River. When Chernobyl happened, again, they, in retrospect, should have evacuated immediately, told people to stay indoors in Kiev. So I guess when talking to physicists, there's no way to put the nuclear genie back in the bottle. Nuclear power will continue to persist. But I wish we had more, you know, sort of community awareness for people who live near these places.
I asked Brown if she thought scientists could help with raising that awareness, or whether she thought that they, like the workers at Hanford and Mayak, would end up identifying too strongly with plant managers.
Well, I think it really helps who's paying your check. At some point in the late 40s, early 50s, scientists at the Hanford plant, these health physicists who are worried about, you know, they're employed to look after workers and public health, they shifted from worrying about the super poisonous product they were making and the super poisonous byproducts they were producing to talking about contamination threat and danger in terms not of public health, but in terms of public relations. The real threat was exposure, not of radioactive isotopes to bodies, but exposure of the plant to the media. And so I think if we could have nonprofit organizations, then scientists, it'd be wonderful to have scientists employed in them who use their expertise and knowledge just to watch, just to monitor, and to inform the public of the kinds of things, the kinds of small and large events and excursions that are going on.
Kate Brown, speaking about her book Plutopia, which is published by Oxford University Press and was reviewed in Physics World earlier this month. That brings us to the end of this Physics World podcast. We'll be back next month with another edition, and in the meantime, you can catch up with all the latest physics news, analysis, features, and book reviews on our website, physicsworld.com. Thanks for listening.